Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey friends, welcome to the Tinnies and Bagels podcast. This is Andre, and Owen and I recorded this episode about our thoughts on Wimbledon in a pretty conversational way, so it didn't really have as much of a structure as we normally try to have. But bear with us, it's still a pretty interesting episode, I think, and it's pretty much the welcome from Owen to the podcast from a bit of a period that he took off. But yeah, welcome Owen, and enjoy this podcast.
The one thing that frustrates me wasn't necessarily the final of this tournament. I thought this tournament was brilliant. It was just how much people are so quick to like turn the attention to the ATP right away just because we finally got the Alcaraz-Djokovic match. When I think that the WTA this year has been phenomenal. Like Roland Garros is like way better than the women's tournament, tournament, in my opinion. I feel like the semifinals and final is like unbeatable. Like the I don't even remember exactly who was in the semis, like in the men's side, but obviously Djokovic and Alcaraz. I don't even remember who was on the other side at this point.
It was like Rude and Zverev, and Rude like demolished him terribly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like no chance. Like what Karolina Muchova did was ridiculous. I don't even know who she lost to like in this tournament, but I know it was a battle. And just what Świątek did in this tournament, just like really like toughening it out and just like trying to win in three and just not playing her best surface, like, but just trying to find a way. Great, absolutely great number one mentality. Four-time Grand Slam champion. What Jabeur did was phenomenal. It was a real shame that she didn't win that final, but also so happy because Von Drusova finally got some sort of closure, like in that regard, because so many injuries as well, like in her career, so many issues. Like she reached the final before, and it's not like she's one of those that reaches the final and then never again, in a sense. Obviously, at that point, he was like that, but it was for reasons beyond her control. So it's just looking at the WTA and just like drawing conclusions from that final alone, so simplistic. It's like, it's not holistic at all. Like, it does not represent how incredible the WTA has been this past like 3-4 years.
And I think Juan Ignacio said this on Twitter, but it's like, it's a lot of it is that best of five thing. Like the men's final is like this 4-hour, 40-minute epic. There's a lot of time to watch it. There's a lot of time for twists and turns, and then it just dominates the conversation. And the women's final is over quickly, and the men's final just kind of swept aside the conversations about like the amazing women's semis and just an outstanding tournament as a whole. I mean, you talked about Iga Świątek. Like, I agree, the way she battled, the way she beat Bencic, and then Elina Svitolina comes along and basically beats Świątek with her forehand, which Svitolina, like, amazing player, really well-rounded. We don't think of her as having like a cannon forehand, but in this match she did. And then you have all the conversations like big three with Świątek, Rybakina, and Sabalenka. And then you have Ons Jabeur come along and beat two of them back to back. I mean, for me, like you said, it was gutting that Jabeur didn't win the tournament. I mean, I was very happy for Von Drosova. She played really, really well, unquestionably deserved it. But Jabeur, I thought she was going to lose to Rybakina again. I thought Rybakina's serve was going to be too good on grass. She loses a tiebreak, comes back and wins 6-1 in the third. Then I thought she was going to lose to Sabalenka just because Sabalenka, like, just the weight of her game is insane. The weight on all of her shots, the power, it's like, certain players come up against her, and it seems like the only thing you can do is just be like pushed out of the way, you know what I mean, by all that power. And Jabeur, like, the way she won that match was crazy. She was on the brink of losing in the second set. She was down a set. She's down 4-3 with a break. And the way she turned it around with just amazing returning of serve, it was crazy. And after she won, and Blair Henley beat me to the punch on this by tweeting it, I thought, like, it's a big four. Like, Jabeur has, like, unseated two of the big three. Like, it's she deserves to be right up there, even though the other three of them are all major champions and she isn't yet. And then that final was just really tough to watch. I think there are a lot of reasons that it happened the way it did. I mean, Vondrousova had beaten Jabeur a couple times this year. That was one of them. Jabeur was, I think, probably physically and mentally exhausted, and playing under a ton of pressure. But it was just, I thought she was the story of the tournament in general. Men's and women's, after those two wins in the quarters and the semis. And so to watch her story end like that was just very, very difficult. I wonder if that's another reason that the men's final kind of dominated the conversation, is a lot of people were just kind of eager to move on from that feeling.
Of wanting
her to win. And that's just a guess. I'm not sure if that's necessarily correct. But
I think that the men's final really did add, like, the sense of, like, a perfect narrative. Like, the young guy comes in and just, like, in his first final of whatever, like, he's number one. And it's the passing of the torch moment, as we discussed on Twitter and elsewhere. But, like, when it comes to Jabeur, it's just, like, a sense of, like, he falls flat at the end. Because it's, like, you're watching her coming back like this. You would have been the same, for example, if Svitolina were to actually win that tournament. So, like, if it was a Svitolina Jabeur final, either way you would have been like a story of the tournament regardless. Because it was going to be such a ridiculous, like, you know, situation that was like, oh my gosh, like, you have like Jabeur, like, all so much, like, riding on her, like, so much history coming through, and the injuries that she's been through, and, you know, just coming short like last year as well twice, and then Svitolina, she, you know, had a baby, comes back and just, like, reaches Roland Garros quarterfinals, then comes in and reaches, like, the Wimbledon semifinals. Like, if either of them had done that, like, that would just be so many stories to write about it. Like, whereas, like, from Vondrousova winning, I don't feel like anyone was really prepared to follow that story, like, unfold the way he did for her. Which for her is amazing. Like, she's a great champion. She also had battle injuries, but it's just like other people had outshone her, like, story-wise, narrative-wise. Not necessarily tennis-wise, because honestly, I was watching some of the final and some of the way that she played against Vitolina as well. And the way that she battles for every point, like, she's fast, she defends so well. She serves incredibly well.
And
I was like, wow, what can you do? Like, what do you do to win a point against this player? And Jabeur at her best, like, could have found many ways to win points. But it's that moment when she gets tied, you can see in her that she has too many ideas, and that's not every time chooses the right one. And she gets increasingly frustrated by that. So it's the way that it unfolded that kind of fell a little flat, unfortunately, for this one tournament, but the rest of the tournament was magnificent.
Yeah, and I think this is going to sound like I'm trying to take away from what Vondrousova did, and I don't want to do that, because, like you said, she played this kind of baffling brand of tennis for her opponents. It was, like, impossible to solve. Just, like, picks them apart with, like, variety and defense, and it... And she's got a great story coming back from injuries. Like, her husband was cat sitting and had to, like, come down just for the final. Like, amazing. Like, very, very good feel good story. But I think Jabeur and Svitolina, like, the two kind of more, like, the bigger focal points of the tournament. I mean, Vondrousova beats them both. And you could argue that in both of those matches, the loser played their worst match of the tournament, you know? Like, yeah. Svitolina, I think, kind of like Jabeur, was just, it you know, you flatline a little bit. It's like the Jimmy Connors thing after he wins that insane match against whoever it was, like Aaron Krikstein or something, where like he's super old and the crowd is like rooting him on and he wins these five setters. And then I think Jim Courier just like demolished him in the semifinals. Like you hit a point where the tank is just kind of empty. And I feel like that happened to Svitolina in the semis. And then I feel like it happened to Jibber in the final. And so I think it was just kind of, people were very disappointed. I feel like I was very disappointed, and not because Vondrozova won, but because Svitolina and Jibber lost. You know, I was rooting for them. And I don't root for players often, you know. It was like their stories were really, really, really compelling. And I think a lot of people felt that way. And so I think the very end of the tournament was a little disappointing. But just like the quality overall was amazing. And I want to talk about like the big three, like Rybakina, Sabalenka, Świątek as well, because I think they're such major parts of the tour right now. I guess we can start with like the one who made it the furthest in the tournament, Sabalenka. She breaks through this year, winning the Australian Open. Roland Garros loses a semifinal that she probably should have won. Wimbledon, I think this was more a matter of Jibber taking it away from her, but I think you could argue that she should have won this one too. She's struggled a lot in semifinals in the past, and after this, a lot of people are kind of saying like, "Oh, she's choking again. The semifinal thing is back." What do you think of that?
I think the Roland Garros one was definitely a situation where she should have won like 100%. Although I do feel like while she's good on clay, is not her best surface.
Yeah, that's true.
It unfortunately helps neutralize her biggest strengths, which is the power and just the speed of the weight of her shots, like in that regard. But she should have won that one. I feel like there's no question. If you're 5-2 and have match points, that in that moment you have more than enough time to just like pick yourself up and just like say like, no, like let's do this, you know, like yeah. But the Wimbledon final against semis, right? Against Jibber, yeah. I feel like this just Jibber like all the way, because it was a good match. I never had a sense that Sabalenka played poorly, in the sense that like she felt like she crumbled, like she would just like implode. It was just the Jibber just like in the zone like the entire time after she broke, after when Sabalenka broke in the second set, I was like, oh, this is over. I've seen this movie many times, like this is what's gonna happen. And at the end of the day, I was like, even after Rybakina lost, I thought this is Sabalenka's tournament to lose now. Like she's the heavy favorite. Like there is no way. But then she goes back, and the way that Jibber played after getting the break in the second set, the way that she fought that one, he may have kind of played something mentally, like with Sabalenka, maybe kind of startled her a little bit. Maybe she was not expecting that. Maybe some memories came back, but I just feel like she kind of fought for it. And I just feel like Jibber was just too much to handle. Like when Jibber is at her best, like her varieties, like her drop shots, the volleys, slices, the way that she takes the ball early and, you know, just kind of is able to guide it through the court. Like she's able to like use Sabalenka's power against her.
Yeah.
And I felt like that there wasn't much that Sabalenka could have done, especially because she would have needed a bit of a change of strategy, which is not her forte.
Right.
But in that regard, like she, in a way, kind of like Sinner, just likes to hit it hard, but it works for her, as we've seen. But it definitely felt like Jibber, she may not have played the best match that she could have, but I think that a lot of that is because Jibber didn't really let her.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Jibber is a better grass court player than Sabalenka. Yeah. Like, I feel like you can make that argument easily. And yeah, I feel like even if, yes, Sabalenka has lost in like two semifinals this year at the majors, but I feel if she keeps getting to them, that's so impressive on its own. She's won a major, so we don't need to hear any more of the like she's a choker, like she's not good enough. Like she is good enough because we saw it in January. And I also think if she keeps getting to the semifinals, like her game is just so imposing that like she's gonna win one. Like maybe she kind of blows another one or two, but like eventually if she keeps making them, she's gonna win one, because like it's just so hard to resist that power.
Yeah, I would still put her as one of the favorites for the US Open regardless, because having won the Australian Open is a hard court Grand Slam. I feel like that's where she feels the most comfortable as well. So I don't want to put past her like to make it. Świątek won a tough one against her last year. I think she'd be ready to go back and beat her if it comes to that again. But yeah. And just a little bit of a clarification, just because like I had this conversation also with Juan Ignacio not too long ago. When we talk about the big three in the WTA side, don't worry, we are not making comparisons like entirely with the Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, because that's another world. It's the current big three of the WTA tennis that we're talking about. Like this year and the last year, it has essentially kind of felt this way, in which there's like these three women that are dominating, but we understand fully that these are not legendary big three. Like, well, not yet. They could very well become a few ones, but like they're not Djokovic, Nadal, and Federer. So don't worry. We don't mean it in that sense.
Right. I mean, it's just kind of silly to me that people get annoyed about that. Like, it's like you don't own the name Big Three, you know? Like, you own the 20 plus majors, and
that's right.
You need to like look at that and like differentiate. It just Big Three is like a useful term, because like these three, and I would say four with Jabeur now, if like, you know, depending a little on her consistency, but like they're clearly elevated over the rest of the field. So I think it's a useful way to kind of categorize the top players. And then kind of looking at Rybakina as well, her title defense ends with a loss in the quarterfinals, 6-1 in the third to Jabeur, after winning the first set. A really interesting stat about that match, I don't have the numbers exactly, but Jabeur outserved Rybakina, which is really interesting, because I think Rybakina has the best serve on the WTA. It's insane. I saw it in person in the Australian Open semis against Azarenka, who is a phenomenal returner, and Azarenka could not really do much against it for a lot of the match. Yeah. Broke a couple of times, but it just was not. Rybakina dominates the serve return battle against almost everyone. And Jabeur had to beat her pretty comfortably in the end. It was a really emphatic revenge win. So what did you think about Rybakina's tournament?
Unfortunately, I didn't get to watch so much of her final matches. Lost to Jabeur, I didn't get to see it much. But it's always tough to defend a tournament, right? It's a Grand Slam as well. Like, this one has points. She's coming in like probably more pressure, even being named as part of a big three in the WTA. She had a couple great tournaments this year already. Won Indian Wells, got revenge against Sabalenka for the Australian Open. I think it was bound to happen. It's not that I didn't see her winning. I just felt like she wasn't such a heavy favorite. Like, as in, you could have put it like for Djokovic, he has been for Wimbledon. I thought she was a favorite. That she would have been my pick to win, I believe. But it doesn't surprise me all that much. I feel like she had a good tournament overall. I think she should leave it like happy with it. And I do agree with you. I feel like her service is the best on the WTA right now. I feel like it could be a bit more higher percentage on the first, but other than that, like I do feel like she's going to come back and maybe win a few more majors. I feel like she has it in her to win a hardcore major. I would put her right back in contention again at the US Open, depending, even if like her summer hard court season doesn't go as well. Grand Slams are always a different beast. Players can play terrible for 2-3 weeks and then come back and just like win a Grand Slam. So yeah, like in terms of how her tournament went, I think it's kind of a bit of a weight off her shoulders, like as a defending champion. It just kind of, you know, she had this experience now where she was a defending champion at a Grand Slam. And I think that's good learning experience. And I think she's going to take that and is going to be able to do it better next time when she has a chance.
Yeah, I agree. And I think she, I don't remember what the sickness was, but she had some sort of a physical issue that made her pull out of Roland Garros. And there are sort of questions over how much is that still affecting her at Wimbledon? So I think that if it was, that would maybe help with feeling that she didn't necessarily go down with her best stuff, right? And if she comes back next year and is fully healthy, then things will be different. And then kind of looking at Swiatek, still our world number one, Sabalenka very close to taking that away. But how did you, you mentioned at the top kind of the way she battles through these three setters. I mean, against Bencic was just down match point, completely looks like she's going to lose the match. I even tweeted, like, she has the capability to come back from this, but she's going to have to, like, pull a rabbit out of her hat because, yep, like, it really doesn't look like
it. I saw that one.
Yeah, and then she pulls a rabbit out of her hat with these, like, massive forehands, comes back and wins. And it kind of looks like that could be a turning point where, like, oh, when she lifts the trophy, we'll look back on this as, like, the moment. And she lost in the next round. So I think there are kind of positives and negatives to take away here. What were your thoughts on her performance?
Just coming back to, like, the conversation that I had with Juan as well, like, just, we were kind of like in agreement that, like, if Swiatek reaches the quarterfinal, it's a successful tournament for her.
Okay.
Grass is not her best surface. Like, she doesn't have as much experience in that one. And within reason, obviously, it's like a very short season on grass. Not really much of her fault. And she has her technical, not problems, but like setbacks on grass because of the forehand and the way that she takes the ball. Just how it's tougher to do the slides that she does on the open stance on grass. It's not the exact same type of thing. It's just that her game wasn't necessarily built for grass in that regard. But the way that she's played and the way she's battling it out, I think it's great. And honestly, the way that she's done it on grass, where she's not she wasn't a favorite, where would even say that, like, well, maybe she could even lose, like, before the second week, and she didn't, and she pulled off, like, one of those. I think she's growing into a player that is, even though she lost, I'd say that's, she still didn't give good signs for plays just because she lost. If anything, like,
yeah,
I'd be scared, like, oh my gosh, like, look how she did on grass, like,
right,
against a player who plays well on those kind of surfaces, and she battled and toughened it out. She's becoming into that type of seasoned player where she's able to, like, find her best, or just, like, find a win when it matters, like when she's down and she's against the wall. And I think that's an experience that's going to be so valuable for her, like, going into the future, and that this tournament is, like, just mostly full of positives. Like, a negative, it's, as a player, like, you never really want to lose. She also lost, like, was it in two sets that she lost to Svitolina?
Three. I think she won a tiebreak in the second set.
Yeah. So that's still a pretty solid one. Like, I mean, maybe Svitolina would have been a player that, like, she would have expected to beat. Svitolina was having the tournament of her life, in a sense. But, like, at the same time, I think that if you should be on deck, like, she should brush that aside, like, almost the day after, and say, like, look, I'm here now, like, and I know how to win those matches now when I'm against the wall. And if you bring me to, like, a third set, I know that I can still win this. So, like, you're not even safe in that one anymore. Like, it's over. Like, the easy two sets, you either win too easy or lose too easy. That's not anymore the case. Like, this, it's Swiatek isn't for the long run now. And I think that because she keeps the world number one, I think she can even still keep it until the rest of the year. Like, honestly, like,
yeah,
it's possible.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I agree with a lot of that. I think, like, you and Juan Ignacio saying quarterfinals would be a great result. Fully agree with that pre-tournament. This career best result at Wimbledon. I think she battled really well and mostly gave a really good account of herself. It's her worst surface. Like you said, she wasn't the favorite. It was always going to be tough. But I think she could have won this tournament. I think going into that Svitolina match, I know Svitolina played incredibly well, hit amazing forehands, but I think you said it best. Like, she would have expected herself to win that one. That puts her in the semis against Fondorosova. I think that situation is the same. She expects herself to win that one. I think she would have won that one. It would have been tough. She would have had to be really sharp, but I think she has the more imposing game. And then that would put her in the final against Jabeur, who is great on grass and who beat her at Wimbledon in, I think, 2021. An amazing performance. I remember watching that, and I was just amazed at how good Jabeur was. But Świątek has done really well against Jabeur recently, even though they haven't played on grass in a while. So I think she probably likes her odds in that finals, too. And so I agree with everything you said, like, plenty of positive takeaways here, but part of me wonders, like, if she beats Svitolina, like, would she have won the title? Yeah. And I think, and I mean this as a compliment to her, because my opinion of Świątek is so high.
Yeah.
Four-time major champion, like, hard courts and clay courts. I think she's going to win Wimbledon in the future, I think. I think she's going to win the career Grand Slam. And so my expectations for her are really high, and I just wonder, like, I think she was capable of winning this tournament, even this year. And so I wonder if part of her kind of wonders, like, I wonder if I could have won that. Like, I think I could have beaten Jabeur in the final as well, you know? I just wonder about that a little.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when you say, like, oh, you see her, like, in a very high regard, like, I feel like she probably puts herself, like, up there as well. And I honestly, especially right now, I guess, like, watching her, like, pre-tournament as well and, like, post-tournament, like, in hindsight, like, maybe she could have won this. But, like, in hindsight, I'd say also Świątek is probably looking at this tournament and, okay, no more. Like, I should expect myself to win every match that I play from now on. No matter the surface, no matter the ranking, I should win. Because, like, I feel like this is where she should be standing right now. I think that, like, if you're a coach, if you're a team, you should put up a team meeting, like, just pick up the whiteboard and just write, you win every match from now on. Like, there's no more losing. Like, as in,
a lot of pressure.
I'm not exactly, like, as in, like, this is the mindset that you're putting, like, on yourself right now. Because, like, I don't think that if you're on her team and if you're herself, like, I should say, like, I don't think that has anybody that's better than me right now, like, overall on tour.
Yeah.
There's definitely those two players, like Rybakina and Sabalenka and Jabeur as well, who are incredible challengers and they respect themselves a lot. But I don't think that Nadal ever expected to lose to anybody when he entered, like, Roland Garros or any tournament, like, in the US Open. I don't think he entered the court expecting to lose against Djokovic in Australia, not a single time in his career. Even though it didn't turn out as well for him, but I feel like that's the mentality that Świątek should be having right now. I think that's, and I think that's a healthy one, like, in the sense, like, she should believe in herself that she can win on any surface. And I think that next year when it comes to Wimbledon time again, I think she's not gonna be happy unless she wins the trophy. Like, that's where I think that she's going to be now. Like, I feel like that's where I feel like the scary part is, because I think she could elevate herself even further away from the rest of the field.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's, like, a great target for her. Like, okay, like, this year, like, I wasn't at my best, still had a career best result, maybe could have gone further. Next year, I'm winning the title.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a great goal. And, man, I'm so excited for the U.S. Open. Like, I think with that four, Świątek, Sabalenka, Rybakina, Jabeur, I feel, with a couple exceptions, I honestly feel like any of them could beat any of the others. Like, I think Jabeur is going to have a tough time beating Świątek, and I think Świątek is going to have a tough time beating Rybakina. Like, but I think besides that, it feels almost like any of those matchups could go either way, you know? And so, like, I just want to see them all at the end of the tournament, you know?
Exactly.
Like, let's have that be the final four, please, because that, I mean, it's not going to work out that way because, you know, tennis is chaotic. But I'd love to see that. I'd love to see at least a matchup or two between those four. I think the WTA is in an amazing place right now with those four. Like, I think we're starting to see rivalries develop. Like, I think that Jabeur-Rybakina quarterfinal was really, really good for tennis. Like, I think seeing that that final matchup from last year, again, in the late stage of the same tournament, and seeing the result flipped like that, I think is fantastic. Like, because now it's like, they're like scoring blows on each other, you know, like they're both landing meaningful results. And I think that's great because rivalries are so good for the sport. And we're seeing that with Alcaraz Djokovic as well. Like Djokovic got Roland Garros, Alcaraz got Wimbledon. Like it's, you don't know who's going to win. And that makes it really, really enthralling, especially when you're fighting for big titles. So yeah, I'm just so excited to see how the US Open goes.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. I feel like that if the final four are like four semifinals, it's the sort of dream lineup that you would imagine, like every Grand Slam with like Andy Murray, Nadal, Federer, Djokovic. Oh, yeah. It's that type of hype that you'd get, and when it happens, it's brilliant. But I feel like that's one of the things that it would be so exciting. Like, oh my gosh, I feel like Arthur Ashe would like explode if that happened. But yeah, that would be absolutely insane. But now that we just like having like this sort of like hype about the US Open and whatnot, like, and I think you mentioned about like the best of five format before, and I really agree as well, like with the tweet that Juan Ignacio posted, like about how the best of five really just lends itself to like a better narrative than a best of three. And what do you think is, I feel like if people have been saying like a lot about, oh, maybe you should go for like from the quarterfinals onwards, I feel like that could be a schedule nightmare for Grand Slams to like include that in. But at the same time, I feel like if they only started off like finals, that's the only match of the day in singles. Like,
I think that is still a positive difference if they do that.
I know, exactly. And it's like, if you do that, not only differentiate yourself like with the narrative, but also every other tournament is going to be different from that one. Like all the Grand Slams are going to be the only ones to do that if they do so. Because right now, especially with the prospect of 2 weeks Masters counting from like 2025 and so on, I think it's going to be such a little difference like now from the Grand Slams. The only major difference really is it's going to be a 96 draw with 32 buys, but at the same time, like a player could very well win seven matches to win that title, right? It's like Indian Wells and Miami right now. And yes, it does feel different, but for how long can it feel that different? Like, I mean, and
yeah,
isn't that
I didn't like, because it was like, I can't, this is supposed to be a four times a year feeling, not a six or seven or eight times a year feeling, you know?
Yeah, but yeah, I feel like it should be the final, man. They should at least like try to implement the final and see where it goes from there. I know that when you're doing a tournament of that magnitude, when you're doing like a sporting event, you can't just like take your chances with things. Like you really do have to like work on it and just put the money behind it and do research and convince a lot of people higher up that you need that the money is worth it. But it's a project that it should be taken on and considered very seriously to be the finals of a Grand Slam, a best of five. There is plenty of women who express that, not necessarily the desire, but like just the willingness to play like best of five if it ever wins to. Like it's not that they're against it, but it's just like they're not, you know, it's not that they're for it, but they're also not against it. Like they believe in themselves physically and mentally that they can do this. I just think that there's absolutely no reason, and I think that it would be such a great move for the sport and for the WTA in general to put it up in like a best of five.
I agree. I mean, there's no reason for like, and the premise is sexist. Like women, they can obviously play the best of five format. They run marathons. They do everything that the men do. Like this is just the only reason that things are this way is because this is the way things have been for a long time, and that initial premise was based on, you know, this incorrect idea that men are like capable of playing this format and women are not. And so I think like, and we see with the best of five, like that that final with Alcaraz and Djokovic, like that was a moment, you know, that kind of escaped our little tennis bubble. And unless you have a three set match that's like as good as it can possibly be, or like is, you know, Venus versus Serena, or just has like really, really compelling narratives, it's just not going to be able to like have the same reach. And I think that is not fair. And I think it would be better if there were more best of five and if women were able to play best of five and had the opportunity. I'm open to like a bunch of things here. I mean, I think if you make the whole tournament best of five, like you're going to have a bunch of scheduling issues, but I think those issues are worth taking on. Yeah. If you're so afraid of that and you want to make it just the final, that's fine with me. That's still a positive difference. If you want to split it down the middle, like when we talked to Juan Jose after the 2021 US Open, we talked about this a little and he said he likes the idea of like men and women.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
First week is best of three, second week is best of five, and so you kind of earn the best of five format. That's fine with me. Mm. Like, but these big matches, it feels like they need to be best of five, doesn't it? Like, it felt wrong that after the tournament Jabeur had, it was possible to lose the final in as little time as she did.
Yeah.
You know? That was barely over an hour. I don't know. I don't really see that change happening, but I'd really like to see it.
Yeah, it's gonna take like a really massive movement to change that. Like it's not something that's gonna happen overnight. But yeah. And especially now, it's not like the Grand Slams will have to come together and decide it, because now they have like all the scoring systems the same and they try to go for more unity. So it's not like you could say, for example, the US Open would decide that they're going to go best of five. It's just not going to happen anymore. If anything, it's gotten harder for this to happen. But
right. I mean, the format's getting shorter. I mean, best of five in doubles has gone away. In doubles, the extended fifth sets are gone everywhere. So we're not trending in the right direction here.
Yeah.
I think that's really unfortunate. But I mean, overall, fantastic women's tournament. I think there's some really, really exciting storylines heading into the summer hard courts in the US Open. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
Not really. I think it's just excitement. Like, it's interesting feeling now going back to the tail end of the season now, because we know there's not exactly the tail end, we're more or less like halfway, but after the US Open things slow down a lot for fans. So it's just interesting, like this last stretch before the last Grand Slam of the season. Hard courts, just excited for it, excited to be able to watch tournaments in a more reasonable hour probably, because now that we are all in America, and it's mostly going to stay about, you know, East Coast as well. So sorry, Vansh, I know you go West, but, you know, that's about it. It's a really great tournament. And despite all that we've talked about and that I've said about like best of five as well, still, like if you know tennis and you're a fan and you get into it, like it's still like really a wonderful tournament to watch, and really great stories as well. And honestly, hoping that Jabeur can put her hands on a Grand Slam trophy sometime very soon. So yeah, all the best luck for her.
Yeah, I feel like the entire tennis world is kind of riding with her on that on that quest. So yeah, all the best to her there as well. Who knows, maybe the US Open, she made the final last year, she has what it takes, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, so something I wanted to ask you was, like, as a Djokovic fan, and we can, like, go into this more later, but, like, did it hurt? Like, how was it for you watching the match?
I watched a few of it, and it's, like, there's always just this hint of, like, me wanting him to win. But yeah. At the same time, it's, like, I've been getting to a point of my tennis fan life in which I'm just kind of, like, wishing for something new to come, because obviously... Yeah. Novak's retirement is not that far away either, even though he looks super fresh. It's not gonna be running forever. So, it was just really exciting watching Carlos win. Like, I feel like he's a guy that I can really get behind in the future. So, like, it's nice to see it. But I think what hurt more was not even like Wimbledon itself, was the fact that now he doesn't have another chance at the calendar Grand Slam.
Yeah,
just like. Man, if he did it this time, I'm pretty sure he would have been in a much better position at the U.S. Open than he was in 2021.
Yeah, I thought about that too. And I kind of did want him to do it, just because, like, that would, like, that's the one thing that would finally shut off all the haters. You know what I mean?
True,
like,
yeah.
And what I kind of wanted to happen, like, you know, in fantasy land, was, like, I wanted him to win the calendar slam, get to, like, 25, and then just retire. And that would be
brilliant.
And that way all his fans can, like, scream that he's the GOAT forever. All his haters are happy because he's finally gone. Yeah. And, like, and it works out for everyone. And, like, I think in the end it was just, like, calendar slam in this era is way too hard for anyone. Like, you just can't do it. I think he got as close as he could possibly come without doing it, because he did the four in a row, and he was 27-1 in two different calendar years, right? Mm-hmm. Like, 2015, if he had won the French Open, I mean, maybe it's a different, like, universe, but he won 3 out of 4 and then made the final, yeah. And then 2021, obviously, but, like, it's just way too hard. Like, way too many opportunities to slip off.
Yeah. And it's, like, in a way as well, as a tennis fan, like, it just even beyond that, like, I feel like, how awesome would it be to just, like, watch somebody do that? Like, I mean, the calendar Grand Slam happened, like, last time in 1969.
Yeah,
and then happened in the women's side in 1988. For both of those, I wasn't even born yet, so it's like I kind of wish I could just see it happening. But it's just like it looks like even more impossible now. But who knows? Maybe if Djokovic decides that he's going to retire this year, Alcaraz could probably pull it off the next. So, because nobody's going to challenge him. Like, if he looks at it, like, it's like, it's going to take some effort, and it can happen, obviously, but it's going to take an effort to beat him. Like, anywhere at this point, yeah.
Absolutely. And, like, maybe we can use this as an opportunity to kind of start talking about the tournament, because something I was thinking is that I think that final is really going to be a wake-up call for, like, Sinner and probably Runa, because, like, you look at that semifinal between Sinner and Djokovic, and, like, Djokovic didn't play that well. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't super sharp. Sinner could hurt him. You know, he took him to 5 sets last year. And you look at the way that match unfolded, and after Djokovic wins in straight sets, he barely celebrates. He celebrates like that was the first round. And then you watch what Alcaraz did to Djokovic in the final, and I wonder if that is going to leave Sinner thinking, like, I wonder if that could have been me, and how hard am I going to have to work to get to that point? Because I think what he did this tournament, he made his first major semifinal, and, like, I know it was a soft draw, but, like, that's not nothing, right? But I think his performance against Djokovic, like, that's just not going to cut it. And so I wonder if watching his rival be the one to do what he wanted is kind of going to motivate him even more.
Yeah. I think it's interesting how Alcaraz's career has unfolded in a sense, because before I didn't really used to think that there was much about, like, talent in anything. Like, I thought it was just, like, mostly, like, in a sense, hard work and passion. Like, if you work hard enough, because we know that the vast majority of the top 100 has an insane amount of talent compared to the rest of the world. So it's like, they don't hit, like, weak balls. They're just, like, a bit of, like, a bit more clutchness, or just the ability of going down the line when you're, like, 30, 40 or something like that. It's just that it's something a little bit more mental. Watching Alcaraz, like, play, I'm just revisiting that and thinking, like, maybe there is something, because this guy is built different. Like, his mind works like the greats. You know, he works like Sampras did, and Agassi did, and Borg did, and Djokovic does, and Federer used to. He's like, he just has this this unwavering belief that, and we, when he loses a point, you can see in his frustration, not because he lost the point, but because he feels like he should have won it. And it's like, my dude, what's happening? And it's like, you're in front of Djokovic in a Wimbledon final. It's your first, like,
it's his first.
My goodness gracious, it's unreal, like, what that guy is able to do, like, how much he believes in himself, how much he, like, is comfortable being in that position. And he wasn't, and interestingly enough, his body wasn't comfortable in Roland Garros in the semifinals. He comes back and just, like, immediately, like, another five-setter. It's not like he made it off, like, in three sets and they could just, like, oh, maybe if he went to, like, a fourth of it, he would have cramped. No, he actually survived.
Yeah,
the bathroom break and losing the fourth set to come back and also save break point, and just like, oh my goodness, that was unreal.
But
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to talk about there, but yeah, I think any good place to start is kind of the rate at which he's improving. And this has been very widely talked about, but you just hit on it there. Like Roland Garros, that match, he was favored to win.
Yeah.
Djokovic wins the first set off him pretty comfortably. He has some break points, but Djokovic could have won that set 6-1, ends up winning it 6-3. Alcaraz has to fight tooth and nail for the second set. And he said afterwards that, like, the nerves and the tension, he was just on edge the entire time. And that was it. He had nothing else in the tank, full body cramp. And then for the rest of the match, there's only one player on the court. That was 5 weeks ago. And he has said in interviews, like, oh yeah, I'm like totally different now than I was then. That was 5 weeks.
Yeah.
Like, that's not very much time. He was not favored to win this Wimbledon final. He was playing Djokovic, the seventh-time champion. He'd won the last four in a row. And he takes the first set off Alcaraz 6-1.
Yeah.
And then Alcaraz comes back and beats him. Like that, I mean, it's hard to think of too many mental achievements that are more impressive than that.
I mean, he was supposed to be like Nadal in 2006, like when he lost to Federer. He was supposed to be happy to be there, you know?
Yeah.
But he just comes in and just like, no, I'm going to do it. Yeah. And he does it. And yeah, it's just impressive stuff from him. Like, it's the sky's the limit. Like it makes you wonder. And I know I just saw a tweet from you talking about recency bias, but I'm going to recency bias myself anyway. It's just like, it's hard to see, even like, could Djokovic win another Grand Slam at this point? Like, what if Alcaraz crosses him at this point? I mean, I'm not gonna say it's not impossible, but who knows? Maybe he cooks Djokovic in five in a semi or something, like if Djokovic ends up dropping to third and then like comes into the final, I don't know, loses to a fresher or whatever, Medvedev in the US Open. Could happen. I mean, this is definitely, like, in my head, it sounded a lot more intelligent than I've been saying, but like, I don't see Djokovic winning maybe like, I think I would say like two or three more slams in him. Whereas before this final, I could even like easily see another five, but yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, and I get the point you're making. Like I'll, for the record, he's going to win more. Like he's so good. Like he won the first two this year. He's 10-time champion at the Australian Open. He could even win Wimbledon again next year, but
probably,
like, I'll say, like, if he and Alcaraz play again at the U.S. Open, like, I'd favor Carlos in that at this point. Like, it's going to be very, very hard to beat Alcaraz anywhere. And I think this, and what you said about, like, the top 100, the difference is mental. There's a lot of truth to that. But with Alcaraz and Djokovic, the difference between their technical skills and everyone else is gigantic. I mean, you watch Alcaraz and Djokovic play that final, and the way they defend, like, no one else can do that. You know, if you're, I don't know, Matteo Berrettini, you can give him the best nutrition, the best coaches, the best injury luck. He is never going to be able to move like that, you know? Like, Alcaraz, I didn't think it was possible for anyone to, like, out-defend Djokovic on grass, and he somehow did it, you know? Like, and that is just not like a physical possibility for most of the players on the draw. I mean, did you see what Alcaraz did to Medvedev in that semifinal?
I did. Go on. I'll say my point afterwards.
It made me want to cover my eyes, right? Because it was like, for all we talk about, like, Alcaraz is such a terrible matchup for Tsitsipas. It might be worse for Medvedev. Like, Medvedev could have played that match 100 times, and he might not have won any of them, you know? Alcaraz is so good and so complete. And this is what we've said about Djokovic for, like, 100 years now, that, like, there's some matchups you just can't unlock him. It's impossible, you know?
Yeah. It's, like, what I saw in against Medvedev is basically a repeat of what happened in Indian Wells. Yeah. But on a fast court, it's like, it makes you wonder, even like, does Medvedev even stand a chance against Alcaraz anywhere at this point? Because it's like,
not on play, certainly, right?
Yeah, absolutely not. But the way that he couldn't get out of his, like, his predicament on the serve return dynamic. He was returning Alcaraz's serve, and that was no answer. He just couldn't do anything, and like, Alcaraz just was so comfortable that he could just throw in, like, an occasional server volley. And he did it several times. And he would just, like, win the point because Medvedev is so far away. He could have some tea while waiting for the ball to come back to him and just, like, decide which side he wants to drop shot the volley. And Medvedev is not going to be anywhere near that ball, no matter how fast he is, no matter how well he can anticipate where the ball is going to go. It's just too far. And then he got back to the baseline and he just couldn't return because it was coming way too fast at his forehand. And I think that was when you mentioned technicality, it's like technique rather. Matt Willis, he posted something about on Twitter about how Medvedev's technique isn't really helping him on the forehand side. And it's crazy how at 20 years old, Alcaraz is complete technically, like strategically, in the mind side of things. It's just what's it going to take? Who is going to do it? I mean, you can pinpoint like little problems with everyone. They say like this, it can be explored. But with Alcaraz, the best that I can think of is you can rush his forehand sometimes. But Even still, like that's his best shot. It's like a la Nadal. Like, are you brave enough to go to this forehand to break him?
And even if you can do it successfully for a bit, you're not going to be able to do it over five sets.
Yeah.
Like you see it with Nadal, players try that strategy. And unless you're Djokovic, like Let's say you hit your backhand better than ever. You do it for a set, but then either you start missing or you drop the ball short and you get destroyed by the forehand. Like And man, with Alcaraz, I mean, there are so many things that make him special, but the return of serve, I think, is the real X factor here because, I mean, you can start with the way he returns Djokovic's serve in that final. You know, Vaunt has talked about that with Jack Edward on Jack's podcast. But he limits Djokovic to two aces and 62% of first serve points won. And I know it was windy and whatever, but the Djokovic serve in the past few years, he serves everyone off the court. He serves everyone off the court. 2018 Wimbledon semifinal, he aces Nadal 23 times. He's winning like 80, 85, sometimes like 90% of his first serve points. And Alcaraz limits him to 62%. Alcaraz broke him, I think, trying to think, I can Google this, like four or five times. It's crazy. And he was leaning to the right side on almost every serve. And we know Djokovic's toss is like unreadable. He can hit these tiny targets. He's one of the best spot servers ever. And Alcaraz was just like in return game after return game here at the sets here. Yeah. 5 for 19 on break points. He won 74 points on the return. Djokovic won 56.
Yeah.
So this is a guy who can win the serve return battle against Djokovic on grass. No one has been able to do that In the past decade. And he's 20 years old.
And that's a really huge testament of like how important it is to focus on that area of your game, right? Because I think you've commented as well, like on a few players who said they openly said that they don't practice the return up serve, and it's just
Federer
like
Federer has said that.
I know, but like I mean, when you look at Federer's career, it's insanely good. But
he
got away with it because he's Roger Federer. But even still, if he had returned better in his career, so many times he could have broken serve like here and there. To you know, just win that crucial game or just get back in a set. Like, and maybe he missed opportunities. Like, obviously, like, anyone would take Roger Federer's career, but still, like, it's, he could have been better just by that one little aspect. And
yeah,
people neglecting to see how important it is nowadays after we had ages of like Andre Agassi and Novak Djokovic, Rafa Nadal, even like people exploring, like with the return of serve, like Dominic Thiem and Daniil Medvedev. How can you not, how can you look at this and think that this is not an important part of the game? It's like, how are you going to win if you don't break serve? You can't rely on just tiebreakers all the time because you're not Karlovic or John Isner.
It's really shocking. Like, I mean, Tumaini Karayal of The Guardian did a piece pretty recently, I think during clay season, where he asked a bunch of players about like the deep return position and the return of serve. And he got a quote from Tiafo that was similar to the Federer thing where he's like, yeah, I don't really practice it. And it's like, is that, do these people not have strategy coaches? Like, is their team not telling them what's going on? Because yeah, we have seen Djokovic dominate for over a decade, and he's the greatest returner of serve of all time. And now Alcaraz has had this meteoric rise, clearly the best returner of serve of his generation. I mean, when you have people who can serve 130 mile an hour bombs to the corner, you need a good return to compete with that. You have to be able to neutralize that. And I mean, you see what Alcaraz did. And when you can return well enough, I mean, you know, that match against Berrettini, I think, is a good example. Yeah. Berrettini's got a massive serve, right? And Alcaraz is such a good returner that I don't think Berrettini's ever going to beat him again. Yeah. Like, going into that match, people gave Berrettini a shot. And, like, Berrettini wins the first set. But after that, he couldn't even get to a tiebreak. He 6-3, 6-3, 6-3 after that. It's such a weapon. If you can break anyone, it's constantly in their head, I have to make first serves. I have to make first serves. That does damage to you, you know? You're going to start missing. You're going to rush. Even if you serve great, you're going to get broken sometimes. Yeah. And so I can't believe more players aren't focusing on that.
And to go back to Berrettini, just, I really like that player for some reason. I don't know, he's grown on me, but I think just Berrettini is just such an intelligent player. He's just like very calm under pressure, even that he's able to pull it off. But you could see that his strategy relied on, like, I got to hold serve because he's not going to be able to break a lot. He needs to, like, land in for serves, needs to, like, put his forehand in play and win the point fast. His backhand was considerably better than it was in the past years, but it wasn't at the level that he could compete on the cross court to Alcaraz. There was just no chance. And you could see that... the only real reason why Berrettini was able to, like, make that match close is because he's good mentally. But, like, a lot of other players wouldn't be able to pull that off. Like, seriously, like, with a game like that one, it wouldn't happen. And, yeah, I think it's going to take a very inspired performance by Berrettini to win against Alcaraz. Otherwise... And Alcaraz maybe to play like blow his best or get injured, because it's on their best days, like 100% Berrettini doesn't beat 80% Alcaraz, like, seriously.
That's it right there. And I think, it's the multiple dimensions in his game, right? I mean, with Berrettini, and to an extent, like Medvedev, like when you're playing Alcaraz, like when Alcaraz gets that serve back, they're kind of done. You know what I mean? Like, they can't hurt him. You know, Berrettini has the forehand, but you get him on the move and he's neutralized. Alcaraz, like, and Djokovic, and I think this is one of the main things that makes them so good, you return their second serve deep and to their weaker side, and that does not even guarantee that you're going to win the point, right? Because, like, they have this explosive movement and these great backhands. So you can hit an amazing return. For the people listening to this, go back and watch the highlights of the final fifth set. I think 0-1 Alcaraz serving, and he is game point. Djokovic hits this backhand return down the line off a second serve. It's perfect. It's a beautiful return. He could not have hit it any better. Parallel to the line, but Alcaraz just, like, runs and does this sliding squash shot into his forehand, gets it back, and then ends up winning the point with a forehand winner. So when you can, like, defend your serve, not just by serving well, but by kind of defending good returns, it's just so hard to hurt you. And Alcaraz and Djokovic have that, and it's like it gives their games, like, a force field. And for a certain player, it's just kind of impossible to penetrate that.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest things, and I've already mentioned, like, how complete Alcaraz is in, like, all dimensions, but to go back, like some players that you've mentioned before, like Yannick Sinner and Holger Rune. I guess you can put Tsitsipas and Casper Ruud in the mix, even though Casper Ruud then doesn't hate grass so much that he couldn't even wait to be out of the tournament. But
that was hilarious. If we have time, I want to talk about that.
But I mean, if there's a surface that you can hate, it's grass. It's only 5 weeks, so
yeah, exactly.
Whatever.
You should do a whole episode on grass. But yeah, I keep going.
But yeah, I mean, it's when I look at Sinner, I think Fosh said it once. It's like he's a good version of like a 2.0 Rublev type of thing. Like he's one dimensional, but he's so good from the ground and that he, you know, can blast anyone off. But like I was watching his match against Safiulin, and by contrast, some of his match, part of his match against Djokovic, and you could see in his eye, like in the way that he played the match against Safiulin, where he lost a set, by the way, is that that was his element. It's just like, I just want to hit hard and I want somebody to hit hard back at me. So it's just going to like become like this like punch out contest. And it's going to be a one-sided match, but it's going to look very impressive because they're going to hit the ball like as hard as possible. They're going to have to change the ball every 3 games, not 7, just because of how hard they're like destroying that ball. And then you come up against like a player who has like, who can hit hard, but is going to choose to use more strategy, like a Djokovic. And you could see in his face that like he is either annoyed or thinking too much about what he's going to do next, or frustrated that like his shots are not producing winners all the time. It is the one thing about Sinner for me is that idea that like I just want him to like find ways to win points in many different ways, like to hit more spot servings, like more second serve, like with more of like a variety, or use maybe a slice backhand or something like that, or just going to the net, just like using a drop shot, like using more topspin, just try to find some ways to like use your ground strokes, and then you can just, I don't know, use it as a surprise tactic, just blast a forehand down the line, just because nobody's like expecting for that. But like when you're expecting that at every shot, it kind of gives rhythm, and you know, players like Alcaraz, Djokovic, even like maybe Rune, I think they're really good in like getting on rhythm and just working like clockwork. And Rune, for me, I think he just didn't believe. I think Rune was what I felt Alcaraz should have been in the final. He was happy to be there. Like,
yeah,
I felt like Rune was just like, he felt like, I can't beat this guy, but he tried his best. I think he's going to come back. I feel like he's got a lot of talent that is unexplored yet.
He's going to win majors.
Yeah.
But not for a while.
Yeah. I think he could be like, he could be number one maybe for a while. Like, he could be like, yeah, I think he could like have some maybe 3-4 majors like in a good period, like a 2 to 3 years. Like, it wouldn't surprise me. I think the kid has a lot of game, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's kind of similarly well rounded to Alcaraz. Yeah. He doesn't really have a weakness. I mean, he's not, I don't know if he's as good in any department, but yeah, I mean, happy to be there. There's a point in that match, I think like third set, Alcaraz is like holding for 4-2 or something, but they play this like cat and mouse point and Alcaraz wins it with like this dink cross court, and Rune like claps, but the way he claps was like, it was like overly respectful, you know. It was like, you know how Djokovic does that clap where like he's impressed? Rune like, he like lifted it up and it like wasn't even sarcastic, and I was like, oh dude, you don't like, you've tapped out, you don't think you can win this. I think kind of the same thing with Sinner against Djokovic, but in a different way. Like, I think Sinner tried his best, but I don't think he was ever convinced he was going to win that match, or even that he could. I mean, if you just look at the break points he missed, most of them are by missed forehands from neutral positions. Like, people have talked about like the forehand is error prone, and I'm like, it's supposed to be his best shot. You know, if you're making mistakes like that with your best shot, then you have no chance. You have to be able to trust that shot, and he couldn't. So, I mean, like that set point in the third set, he hits a great return and he gets a mid-court forehand and he misses it by a couple of feet. Like it wasn't like you go for a winner and you miss it by that much. And it's like, oh man, like a bit more margin would have helped, but like, I respect that they went for it. It was like, it felt like he missed by a football field. And errors like that just aren't going to cut it. Yeah. But I I kind of wanted to move on a little bit because I still want to talk about WTA and everything.
For sure. Yeah.
And the rest of the men's tournament. But I feel like that final was so kind of all-consuming that, like, before we finish up on this part, were there any moments that stuck out to you in the final that you want to talk about?
The... Which one? The WTA?
No.
ATP.
Yeah.
I feel like the moment that stuck out to me a lot more was, like, the similarity between that and the Australian Open against Dominic Thiem, where he took, like, a longer break than normally would have been. And in my head, I was like, oh, geez, if he comes on and wins this match, the hate is going to be unparalleled on Twitter. But, I mean, he lost, so I guess that was basically the only thing that I was, like, on my toes, like, looking at, like, a Twitter, like, monitoring, like, what are people going to say about this? But aside from that, like, really, it was just definitely felt like Alcaraz was fresher physically, if not just by age, just because he's, like, younger. It just felt like he had the, you know, the youthful movement. They just, like, running around, very explosive. Djokovic is in his late 30s right now, mid-30s, really, and kind of conserving energy, using it, like, in proper moments. But it's not like I felt the age gap in this match, but I feel like it's not getting any better. You know what I mean? It's just, yeah. it's starting to, I feel like Djokovic probably is going to start to decline, maybe by mid next year towards the end. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I feel like it's coming close to it. So yeah, that's basically the one last thing that I had to think about, which is great in the sense of, like, passing the baton, because, like, you have Alcaraz on the rise and then Djokovic.
Yeah.
Maybe ending his career somewhat soon, but who knows?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'll go on record. I've said, like, I think Djokovic is, like, better than he's ever been. And I think this match was kind of an interesting counterpoint to that, where, like, Alcaraz, like you said, Alcaraz kind of had more in the tank physically. He was able to, like, out-defend Djokovic a little bit. And so I think this match maybe demonstrated, like, maybe Djokovic isn't better than he's ever been. He's maybe more efficient at beating weaker opposition. But when it comes to someone who is as good as him, he maybe can't compete in quite the same way that he could in 2012 or 2015. But, I mean, he still impressed me. Even Djokovic still has the highest peak in men's tennis. Like, even higher than Alcaraz, the way he won that first set, the way, like, that was like, stunning. And, like, I know Alcaraz won the third set 6-1, but that was different. That had a 27-minute game. That set was a war. That set took, like, an hour. That first set, Djokovic beat him like he was a junior. No one else can play like that still. And it's like he's 36. It's crazy. And so even though he lost, he still impressed me. And then another thing that stuck out to me was just, like, kind of that moment of catharsis for, like, the fans of all the players who Djokovic has, like, beaten in these close matches, because Djokovic finally lost another 5-set major final. That had not happened since 2012 at the U.S. Open, I think. He had a break point in the fifth, which we don't need to dissect because I think everyone else is doing that. Had a swing volley, missed it. Won the first set, had a set point in the second set, and he actually, like, had a couple moments where it was like he choked a little bit, you know, and that just has not happened at all, which is why it's so frustrating to root against him for everyone. For everyone who does, because he never loses the way you want him to lose. And I think Alcaraz kind of beat him in the way that everyone was hoping someone would at some point. So I think that was, I think a lot of the tennis world kind of felt like they needed this, whether tennis actually did or not. And so I think it was a very satisfying match for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely satisfying in a lot of ways. Definitely feels like a, maybe a new chapter is finally beginning. Like, again, like, it's very tough not to be afflicted by some sort of recency bias. It's very tough nowadays to say that this isn't happening. It's going to take an injury or Alcaraz really dropping his level for it not to happen at this point, which I think it doesn't look super likely, but you know, maybe it's gonna take Djokovic finally retiring for it to happen in a way. But I want to believe that Alcaraz is gonna keep going. So
yeah, and I mean we can talk about the passing of the torch for a minute. I mean, some people are like, oh, it's not a passing of the torch because Djokovic is gonna win more majors. I'm like, does that mean it's not a passing of the torch? I mean, Nadal beats Federer in the 2008 Wimbledon final. Everyone screams changing of the guard. Then Federer wins two majors in 2009 and he wins five more, or like five or six more overall, right? Like, I mean, it's pretty clear that like Djokovic is nearing the end of his career and Alcaraz is this meteoric talent who has won a bunch and is going to win even more in the future. I mean, I think that's as clear as it gets, really. I have no problem calling it a passing of the torch.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to this episode. You know where to find us on social media. In fact, I hope you find us on social media and you send your messages to us, any comments or anything. You just want to talk to tennis at any time. And we do want to improve our content at every episode, at every try, every opportunity that we get. So yeah, feel free to reach out to us on Twitter at Tennis and Bagels. And you can talk to us individually as well at Tennis Nation for Owen. Vonsch is at VonschV2K and me is at Rolenberg Andre. So thank you very much for listening and have a good one. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.